Okay. So, rule number one about making a new podcast, you can actually sometimes delete the whole episode. So, that being said, I think I can recover it. So, this is going to be me basically using the already available resource before it goes down to redo the episode. This is going to be awesome. So, hopefully this works out. Thanks.
Hello, I'm Marvin Dougal, a current political science and history student at Kansas State University, as well as former Submariner, nuclear reactor mechanic, and this will be the first installment of a many podcast long series. I have a $15 parking citation, can't pay for a car, pretending I have insurance for a car that I don't think I still do because I think they cancel it for non-payment. I'm just going to pretend I don't know that. Colleagues and friends of mine have long suggested I make a pod, but perfect is the enemy of good. And so I've never felt capable of making a podcast before. Instead of starting and making it better over time, I wanted to be out of the gates with the most professional and meaningful production I could muster. That isn't this podcast. It'll be good, hopefully, and it will grow better with time, but as I mentioned above, I'm poor, and I'm sick of contemplating the abstract while sustaining myself on the free pizza from work. This is my attempt, my Hail Mary, to turn my words and my lust for learning into something that can make my stomach stop screaming at me. A back-of-the-envelope calculation says a 30-minute pod should be about 4,500 words, so let's see if I have that in me. For my very first episode, we're going to do nuclear power. I'd like to just take a second to plug my Patreon. You can find it under the same name as the podcast. Okay, without further ado, much about nothing, this is the Just the Facts with Mark podcast. We'll look into current problems, their historic origins, and potential ways to solve these issues, all the while with the use of facts and rational argumentation, which hopefully leave the audience with a general knowledge of current affairs. That is to say, at least for the time being, this podcast will seek to provide to those with little knowledge of topic the basic building blocks of understanding necessary to competently view the world around them. Today's topic will cover the origins of our current understanding of nuclear physics, including radioactivity, some common misconceptions about the effects it causes, and civilian and military applications. I enjoy a good story, and sometimes that will lead me down a tangent of related stories. I'll try to keep those brief and topical so that they don't detract too greatly from the overarching theme. Here's the first one, though. In 1867, 2 years after the end of the American Civil War, a young chemist of immense importance was born in the city of Warsaw in modern-day Poland. The reason I say modern-day Poland is because most people, I'm sure, don't know that Poland didn't officially exist as a nation-state at the time. Rival empires so desperately wanted to suppress it that they partitioned it on three separate occasions starting in 1772. My favorite line from this period, which, while it's potentially apocryphal, still wonderfully lays out the feelings of the time, came from Frederick the Great. He's the king of Prussia. And he said, in describing Maria Theresa of Austria-Hungary's feelings of partitioning Poland, she weeps, and yet she takes. She took anyways. She didn't care that much. The second partition occurred in 1794, following the failed uprising of General Kosciuszko, a native Pole who aided the American Continental Army throughout the war, including in the Battle of Saratoga. For his assistance, a town in Mississippi was named after him, and I recommend everyone take a moment to watch a video of people from Mississippi trying to pronounce Kosciuszko. It's spelled like you wouldn't expect. It's really hard. And they call it Kazakowski. Following this uprising, a third and final partition was made of Poland, and for 123 years, until World War I, it ceased to exist as a country. In this extension of the Russian Empire then, in 1867, was born Marie Curie. Curie, who, if you had forgotten, was who we were alluding to before my tangent. In the years leading up to her discovery, and I think most students are taught this in science class, Antoine Henri Becquerel left a piece of what we now know to be radioactive material inside his desk drawer with a sheet of film. When he came back to look at this film, he realized that it was already exposed, not to light, but to what we now call X-rays. Curie analyzed an ore taken from the ground called pitch blende. It's often also called uranite and forms the backbone of where we get our raw uranium from. This is because, in case you haven't noticed, uranium is hard to come by, and so pitch blende, which we now mine in the Rocky Mountains, parts of Canada, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, is a prime candidate for getting the element, given its much higher concentration of uranium. To put this in perspective, if we were to get together enough U-235 by sifting, a non-technical term, it's a lot harder than that, through the soil to make the little boy bomb, which we dropped on Hiroshima, it would take over 83 metric tons, or the max takeoff weight of the Airbus A321. Those numbers were computed by me using a U.S. Geological Survey paper, along with other sources for U-235 concentrations in nature, so they're probably right. As a matter of fact, an army.mil history of the Manhattan Project recounts that some 1,200 tons of the ore was moved from the Congo to America during World War II in order to conduct the Manhattan Project, which gave us our first bomb. What Curie noticed about her pitch blend, however, was that if her X-ray readings were correct, the ore must be composed of other elements besides uranium. Her discovery of radium and polonium, named after her homeland of Poland, earned her a second Nobel Prize, this time in chemistry. She's in fact the only woman in history to win two Nobel Prizes, that's history and physics and chemistry. But the first is of so much consequence that it's the true highlight of her career. It was through her research into what we now call radioactive elements that she was in fact the first person to coin the term. Radioactivity is exactly what it sounds like. The atom is active, constantly ejecting particles, which in her day could be seen by the X-rays and the light given off by them. There are numerous elements which can be radioactive, and in fact, you're surrounded by them daily. If you're a smoker, highly cultivated fields use fresh topsoil each season, which contains trace amounts of that polonium element we discussed earlier. The element decays by emitting alpha particles, which are literally just protons of a helium-4 nucleus without electrons. Those free positively charged electrons can wreak havoc on your cells and DNA. It's therefore why we call it free radicals, the thing you keep hearing about from your health nut friend. The counter, that friend will tell you, is an antioxidant. This is because the proton breaks off your tiny bits and causes them to oxidize and die. The exposure rate for the very short distance those particles travel inside your lungs is way above the legal dose threshold, and because it's kept in place by the tar that's created from burning the plant matter, the tobacco, it can remain in your lungs until it completely decays away, which, along with benzene, form the two major carcinogens leading to lung cancer in America, a disease which the CDC lists as the third most common and most deadly form of cancer, killing more than double the rate of breast cancer. In fact, even if you don't smoke, the average yearly background dose in the United States is approximately 620 milligrams, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That's the NRC. You receive this radiation from sources like the sun, radon in your basement, x-rays you get at the doctor's office, and traveling in an airplane. The airplane radiation comes from the sun, and that there's less atmosphere between you and it to block the harmful ultraviolet radiation being shot at us all day. It's what causes sunburns. It's important to note, though, what kind of radiation we're talking about. The type of radiation which contributes to your exposure is a kind called ionizing radiation. These types of radiation are called alpha, beta, and gamma, and come from the ionization of atoms, which causes them to release a particle, either a photon in the form of gamma radiation, alpha in the form of those nasty protons we discussed earlier, or the lesser-known beta, which is caused by the release of an electron. I mention all this because I want to make clear what kind of radiation matters and what doesn't. For instance, the radiation given off by your cell phone, it's non-ionizing, and therefore it's not harmful. The same is true for modern televisions, although in writing this, it did occur to me that those old cathode ray tube televisions, the really old ones from like the 60s, they probably emit some. And so I looked into it, and I'm delighted to tell you, because these kinds of things I love, those will definitely give you cancer. So how scared should you be about radiation? The answer depends, but in general, not much. The strongest and most penetrating radiation is gamma, but its penetrating power is what lets me sleep at night. See, a grisly analogy for you is that imagine an M16 assault rifle and an AK-47. The larger round of the AK packs such a punch that it will both enter and exit your body before it begins to tumble into your nice, gushy organs. By contrast, the smaller 5.56 ammo of the M16, the equivalent of a 22 long rifle round, usually loses power and begins to tumble through the body, making the bullet actually more devastating. Gamma will go through you, beta can be stopped by your skin, and alpha by a piece of paper. This is why alpha radiating is so damaging if ingested, since it won't easily escape your body, meaning all of the energy released is collected by the surrounding tissue. The potency of alpha was on full display in 2006. See, there's this Russian dissident who used to work for the FSB named Alexander Litvinenko, and he sat down for tea with two of his associates in England. Litvinenko had run amok of Putin's Russia, and even published a book on my reading list called Blowing Up Russia. The book accused the current president, Vladimir Putin, of masterminding a plot to detonate bombs throughout Russia and a false flag attack as a reason to invade the Muslim region of Crimea. A conflict I hope to cover in a future episode. The country is so shrouded in secrecy that we cannot be sure, but the evidence I've read is pretty compelling. As for Putin, we know that his invasion proved to be a major success for his reputation and helped catapult him into office following the Russian Federation's first president, Boris Yeltsin, who took over as leader of the nation following the collapse of the Soviet Union. As an aside, this whole mess is detailed in a book called December 25th, 1991, and I cannot recommend it enough. It's great. But back to our friend Litvinenko. Alexander sought asylum from Putin inside the United Kingdom, but in 2006, following a meeting with Russian assassins, unbeknownst to him, he came down with symptoms of acute radiation sickness. It was finally revealed that the other members of the meeting had put 200 times the lethal dose of polonium-210 inside his tea, and under 3 weeks, he was dead. It was all over the news. I mean, you can look up pictures. Imagine living and could die of acute radiation poisoning. While any amount of radiation, no matter how slight, is dangerous, one does not normally succumb to the symptoms we associate with radiation unless the dose is acute, happening within about a day. Marie Curie, for instance, was most likely killed by her extensive work with radioactive elements, even though it took her decades to do so. The book Radium Girls also covers this topic in relation to the trend in the 1950s in the United States to paint all kinds of items in radium paint, one of those radioactive elements Curie discovered. The radium would glow in the dark, and so it was used to paint clock faces and the like. The girls who used that paint would get the paint all over themselves, including their mouths, and so while there was no fear at the time radiation-induced illnesses, nonetheless, many succumbed to things like jaw cancer from their long-term exposure to the dangerous element. As a change of pace, and I want to get into the really scary stuff, the stuff that's kept generations up at night, nuclear weapons, and reactors. Not long after Curie put a focus on atoms spontaneously decaying, scientists began looking into the possibility of an induced chain reaction with which to produce what Emperor Hirohito would later call cruel bombs. In 1933, as the political climate began to build up into what later became the Second World War, a Hungarian physicist by the name of Leo Szilard first hypothesized the idea for a nuclear chain reaction, and with the help of Enrico Fermi in 1942, the two, along with a team of other physicists, created the first nuclear chain reaction in a reactor known as the Chicago Pile 1. As its name implies, this first reactor was just a crude pile of uranium designed to get the right critical geometry to prove that a chain reaction was possible. The U.S. pursued an atomic bomb, or A-bomb for short, for many reasons, but one of the seminal moments came when Szilard, his colleagues, and even Albert Einstein, the father of relativity, penned a letter calling for its development to the President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, often abbreviated FDR. The production began in Los Alamos Desert in the state of New Mexico and continued there long after the production of the first bombs and the end of the war. An entire makeshift city was built to house the workers, and in a few short years, the U.S. had created the first three nuclear weapons in human history. The first test of one of these weapons was the Trinity Test, which detonated the bomb codenamed Gadget in July 1945, just the month before we blew it up over Japan. There are obvious reasons for testing the Gadget before deploying it, but one reason was that we didn't see a point in giving all of our meticulously isolated uranium to the Japanese. Since science is in fact universal and the same physics we were pursuing was also being developed by the Axis powers, the site is still open to the public today, with just one viewing day per year, in part because the site is still radioactive over 7 years later. Standing at the location of the detonation point is a crude obelisk, which stands as a memorial commemorating this shining achievement for science. The dirt surrounding the blast was turned to glass by the 22-kiloton device, which sent a mushroom cloud high into the air. The head of the project, Robert Oppenheimer, in reflecting to himself, then proclaimed, "Now I am become death, destroyer of worlds," a reference to the Hindu text, the Bhagavad Gita, in which Krishna reveals his true monstrous form. The line is meant to explain to the story's protagonist, Arjuna, then in the end, all would be destroyed, and all one can do is their duty. The bombs created were of two different types. A nuclear weapon and nuclear reactors both work on the premise of fission. Curie might have discovered radiation, and this is forever memorialized in the name we give the measure of it, the Curie, but the intricate particle physics that governs radiation was still unknown to her. Instead, that work was left to the physicists who followed and the engineers of the Manhattan Project. Those scientists were able to describe the process by which a chain reaction would ensue. The requirements were to be a fissile material, whether or not a material is fissile is related to how it undergoes reactive decay. An element is said to decay when it gives off these ionizing particles we discussed earlier. The normal course for this is called natural radioactive decay, and involves the spontaneous coming apart of atoms on an incredibly tiny scale. Over time, the release of this energy reduces the overall mass of the element, such that it slowly, or sometimes quickly, reduces itself down to what is called a stable isotope, or one which is no longer radioactive. We have a word to track this loss of energy called the half-life. The half-life of a radioactive element, the amount of time it takes for half of the element to decay into something else, and often this decay is into another form of radioactive element. The different atoms an element transmutes or turns into is described by something called a decay chain. As an example, uranium-238 goes through many decays, including thorium, several nuclides of palladium, lead, thorium, and bismuth, before finally stable as lead-206. Now, I simply must squeeze this in here. The reason why lead symbol is PB, right? Like, have you ever wondered that? Like, why some atomic symbols are not even close to their names? Like, gold, for instance, is AU, right? Like, this comes from the Latin aurum, which means gold. PB actually comes from plumbum, which was used in lead pipes for plumbing in Rome. Lead can cause neurological issues, and that can be seen today in Flint, Michigan, where corrosive river water was allowed to erode away the protective coating on the city's lead pipes. Anyways, The element the scientists settled on was uranium-235. The U-235 is an isotope of uranium. An isotope in any form as any form of an atom, which is not the most common form. In this case, uranium-238, the non-fissile form of uranium, is the most abundant, and it makes up over 99% of what we find in nature. The first of the two bombs we dropped on Japan, Little Boy, used this fuel. While modernization of our nuclear arsenals rendered this type of design obsolete, the original bomb design was called a gun assembly weapon. Basically, the engineers created a cup of uranium that was two-thirds critical, and then fired down the tube of a repurposed artillery piece, the other chunk of two-thirds critical uranium-235. When the two met, for mere fractions of a second over Hiroshima, the results were catastrophic. Naturally, we must discuss criticality. See, a fun game for those in the nuclear industry is to watch movies about reactors and laugh at all the little mistakes penciled in by scriptwriters without the aid of a science advisor. See, for instance, in the movie K-19, one of the Russian nuclear operators shouts, "The reactor is critical." The tone is supposed to send shivers down your spine. This is a major deal. But it has the opposite effect for someone who understands criticality. And wow, look at that. You can soon be one of those budding movie critics. This is great. Glad you joined me. when the amount of neutrons goes into a reactor or bomb is equal to the number being released, the device is said to be critical. When two neutrons come in and one leaves, it's subcritical. And when two go in and three leave, it's supercritical. Criticality is not a sign of impending doom, but rather one that everything is going just fine. In fact, if you think about it, we could never raise the reactor power level if we didn't spend the majority of startup supercritical. It would just stay the same number of neutrons decaying the whole time. The only thing that separates a nuclear reactor from a bomb is, in fact, the real word that would inspire dread. That's prompt criticality. So, for the first time, I won't actually go into too much detail about prompt criticality because, honestly, I'd lose you. I'm trying to make this accessible to many people as possible, and suffice to say, though, reactors are obviously not meant to go prompt critical, but the kind of catastrophic out-of-control chain reaction that occurs during a prompt critical excursion is the absolutely most important part of constructing a nuclear bomb. Reactors today are designed specifically to never get close to prompt critical, and reactor safeguards like the SCRAM, which use complex electronics to safely shut down the reactor, would never let it happen. And yes, there are a lot of redundancy built into those systems, so much, it's really annoying to learn. They just can't do it anymore. Once upon a time, but not now. Little Boy, the gun-type device, was detonated over Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. 3 days later, on August 9th, a second device named Fat Man was dropped over Nagasaki. Now, unlike Little Boy, Fat Man was a plutonium weapon. It still used fission, but it was an implosion device. This meant that a subcritical mass of plutonium-239 was wrapped in a complicated ball of high explosives, which had to be triggered essentially simultaneously, which is not an easy task at the time. Probably not even easy now. The US bluffed about having more bombs, and the Japanese surrendered promptly afterward. It's worth mentioning that though the devastation was unfathomable, the death count was actually lower than previously carried out firebombings of Tokyo, which killed many thousands more. The fact that the bombs were so devastating, despite the lower lethality, made the bombs something of a terror weapon. In the minds of the enemy, it took up the same place that chemical weapons had in World War I. In fact, chemical weapons did not kill as many people as you think either, but seeing a cloud of fog coming at you, which once it overtook you would cause your lungs to fill with fluid, your skin to blister, etc., got the weapon universally banned quite quickly. With the war over, as we all know, the world returned to peace, and never again did we have to worry about nuclear weapons, or at least that's what we thought. Soon, we began to worry about the Russians getting the bomb, but could at least rest assured that it would take them many years. Unfortunately, though, through the help of the Rosenbergs, a couple that was sentenced to death for espionage in the US, as well as Klaus Fuchs, one of the Manhattan Project physicists responsible for developing the complicated implosion device, the Russians detonated their first nuclear weapon, RDS-1, referred to in America as Joe-1, in 1949, long before we predicted they would have the device. Soon, the Cold War was underway, first with a race to build more capable bombers and better anti-aircraft defenses, and then more capable missiles and better anti-ballistic missile defense systems. Today, 9 countries have nuclear weapons, down from a maximum of 10. This is due to the work of international organizations and treaties such as the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT. The 9 nations which possess the bomb are the US, the United Kingdom, France, Israel, Russia, India, Pakistan, North Korea, and China. And North Korea, obviously, is the last one to get so far. And maybe Saudi Arabia and Iran one day. The only former nuclear state is South Africa, which made weapons and then destroyed them before anyone even knew they had them. Every country has different platforms and different deterrent policies. In the US, for instance, we have about 400 intercontinental ballistic missiles, those are ICBM silos, each loaded down with a Minuteman III missile. many air-launched weapons, including long-range standoff missiles based out of Incirlik in the United States, and 14 ballistic missile submarines armed with the Trident D5 submarine-launched ballistic missile, which is an SLBM. The types of bombs we use now are far more devastating than those used in Japan, and many are hydrogen bombs or fusion weapons. Instead of uranium, these bombs use the heat from a fission bomb to fuse atoms into helium, a process used by the sun which releases much more energy. Furthermore, we possess devices called MIRVs, or multiple independent reentry vehicles. These hold multiple weapons and can even conceal countermeasures, which even our anti-ballistic missile system, the ground-based mid-course defense system, can't reliably defend against. There just is no way to stop them. I think that will conclude our discussion on the bomb, but I still have time to discuss some of my favorite stories. Normally horrific in nature, dealing with the kinds of accidents which have led to reactor disasters and potential nuclear war since the beginning of the atomic age. A good resource for this is Eric Schlosser's Command and Control. It's a wonderful book. Again, can't recommend it enough. First story involves the Army's early attempt to create their own nuclear reactor, and hopefully you can put your newly learned nuclear physics knowledge to the test. Dubbed SL-1, the research reactor suffered a catastrophic failure when one of the personnel was conducting tests. On accident, as he stood over the reactor, he pulled out the wrong control rod. Before he got barely any of it out of the core, the reactor became prompt critical. It's that thing we talked about earlier. In a fraction of a second, all of the cooling water inside flashed to steam. Now, the pressure difference between water and steam is 1,000-fold. So the rod was propelled up through the operator's groin, it broke through his collarbone, and it propelled him into the concrete containment structure above him. That's where emergency personnel found him. The other member of the crew died shortly afterward of acute radiation poisoning. The Army doesn't mess with nuclear reactors anymore. It's a Navy thing. In 1985, the Soviet submarine K-431 was undergoing refueling. The reactor was cooled down to around room temperature and depressurized. The reactor vessel head, the top of the reactor, was removed after disconnecting the control rods, which kept everything stable, then refueled. Following the refueling, the rods were again attached to the vessel head via what are called control drive mechanisms. The vessel head was not correctly lined up, and so upon discovering this, the crane attached to the head was lifted ever so slightly. This moved the rods as well, and full of fresh new fuel, the reactor took off. Again, in a fraction of a second, an explosion blew the entire reactor head outside of the ship and over 200 feet away. 10 men were killed instantly, and dozens experienced radiation injuries. The ship was scuttled, or sunk, in the Kara Sea. It was simply too contaminated to be worth repairing. Finally, a quick look at some civilian nuclear incidents and disasters. The Three Mile Island plant in Pennsylvania suffered a reactor incident in 1979. A stuck relief valve allowed cooling water to flow unnoticed for quite some time. The resulting heat buildup in the reactor caused fuel element failure, which led to a partial core meltdown. The reactor was shut down indefinitely, but the other reactors of the complex have continued operation ever since and are scheduled to finally be turned off this fall, actually. That's fall 2019, in case this goes multi-year. Chernobyl, maybe the most famous reactor accident of all time, occurred when the Russian plant, located in Belarus, meaning Little Russia, a member of the Soviet bloc countries and located just west of the Russian border, experienced a catastrophic failure. Reactor power dipped dangerously low, and when a scram was initiated, the tips of the control rods, which were made of a different material, caused a split-second surge of power. The scram, which is normally spring-assisted to speed up the process faster than gravity can do, blew the entire reactor apart. Soviet design was dangerously poor, and so the containment building was basically a makeshift shed. Naturally, the rods and fuel blew the building apart and littered the whole area with debris. It's to this day the worst nuclear disaster in history, and so the Soviets, who were still so secretive back then, failed to alert anyone. In fact, scientists in faraway European nations had to ask the Soviets what happened because all of their own radiation detection equipment was ringing off the hook. They're like, this isn't us, and they wouldn't tell us anything. I need to make a couple points about this first, before we move on. So the first is that following the disaster, the entire core was encased in concrete. The concrete to this day is slowly falling apart and cracking, allowing ever more radiation to escape. The upside of this, though, is that there's a form of life, like a microbe, which has learned to use this radiation as a source of energy. How cool is that? But secondly, you cannot have crazy three-armed people from something like this. Like, radiation will either kill a cell, do nothing to it, injure it, or mutate it. When a cell mutates, you just get cancer. The only way that you can become really messed up from radiation is if you're in utero at the time. Like, this makes sense, actually. Having one of your 10 trillion cells mutated probably won't do anything. But fetuses, especially when they're just a few cells big, can see an entire quarter or more of their genome haplessly wrecked. Of course, this normally just causes stillbirths, though, so next time you watch Chernobyl Diaries, just keep that in mind. Finally, to wrap us up, the most recent accident. that of Fukushima Daiichi. In 2011, the earthquake and tsunami, which killed tens of thousands of Japanese, also caused the worst nuclear accident of the century. The points I want to make, however, focus on things people get wrong. Like, when the tsunami hit, the power trip initiated a scram. This would have been fine, except the massive storm surge walls built outside the plant could not protect the massive generator outside the complex. That generator is meant to keep cooling water flowing to the reactor. Since the reactor shut down, it's still hundreds of degrees hot. It'd take months to cool down most of the time. The reactor overheated from what's called a loss of flow casualty. The water began to separate into its very explosive constituent parts, hydrogen and oxygen. The resulting conventional explosion blew through parts of the pressure barrier and containment, but didn't produce the kinds of heavy contamination that the shoddy Chernobyl shack released. Instead, the real issue with the plant today is that today over 1 million tons of water has been pumped in the reactor to keep it cool. That heavily contaminated water is building up around the facility in makeshift water storage tanks, and there's no good plan for cleaning it all up. Okay, well, that's it for our first podcast. Again, I'd like to thank everyone who made it this far. I hope it wasn't boring. And I would like to direct one last time to my Patreon account. It's under the name of this podcast, Just the Facts with Mark. And thank you.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.